Because I leave them all the time, and she's like, you cannot leave this one. We only get so many.
Good morning. It is 8:32 a.m., August 30, 2018. I call this informal hearing to order. This is an informal hearing on case number PU-18-89, Montana-Dakota Utilities Company rate reform effects and rates regarding the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. And there's a settlement that has been proposed between advocacy staff and the company. I am Randy Christman, Chairman of the Commission, joined by Commissioners Brian Krasius and Julie Fedorchak, so we have a quorum. I don't have any opening comments. I do have a number of questions, but maybe they'll be covered in the opening comments from the company and from advocacy staff. But otherwise, no opening comments. Commissioner Fedorchak, do you?
Just a couple. So thanks, everybody. I appreciated the willingness. We had originally scheduled this as a work session, which I thought wasn't the most productive way forward, considering we really haven't talked to any of you, the parties that negotiated this agreement, about the agreement. And I thought I really didn't want us sitting here with our advisory staff asking a bunch of questions that they're like, well, we'll go back and ask them. And so I really appreciate everyone kind of in short notice changing schedules or whatever to make this work as an informal. And I look forward. I do have a number of questions. I've met with staff ahead of time. I think they've provided at least one or two questions to you guys ahead of time. And so looking forward to a good discussion this morning about an issue that's really important to us and to you guys and to ratepayers. So thank you.
Thank you. And before I turn it over to the portfolio holder, I guess I kind of skipped a step. We want to just go around and have identified the commissioners, but have everyone identify themselves for the record, which is being recorded. And I want to emphasize this is an informal hearing, which involves only undisputed facts. If there are disputed facts, we will wrap it up and have to move, set a notice of hearing and move forward in that way. So if everyone can speak into the microphones clearly and state your names for the record.
Travis Jacobson with Montana Dakota Utilities.
Stephanie Bosch with Montana Dakota Utilities.
Tammy Eberle with Montana Dakota.
Good morning. Carl Liebitz with MD Resources Group.
Garrett Sanger with Montana Dakota.
Victor Shook with advocacy staff.
John Hsu with advocacy staff.
Okay. This is under Commissioner Krasius's portfolio, so I'll turn it over to you.
All right, thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming in on short notice. And doing this, I also have some questions, and the TCJA obviously has been a positive for ratepayers across the country, and it appears that that is the case here as well, and we'll get into the numbers, I know, through your presentation. Just as a heads up, one question that I really have, I would say probably the largest question I have just as a heads up and to be thinking of this as we're going through everything, and maybe it's in the slides, but the replacement of the pre-1983 underground cable. So that's a big question for me because, not to confuse it with another case, but we had a similar instance where wanted the detail in terms of a component, a replacement project, if you will. So that I probably have 10, maybe 12 different questions related to that issue alone. And just as a heads up to be thinking of that, and then just to get a better handle as well on the breakdown of, I believe in the settlement, it shows $5.49 per customer. I took a sneak peek at one of the slides. I think it says 509, but maybe there's a reason for that. But just to get a better idea of the breakdown, I think I've got the 365 down. I've got another figure from advocacy actually came up with another figure related to deferred taxes, and then I triangulated a couple of other things, but I don't know if I'm right. So just to get a better handle on that, and maybe that might make your explanation of the slides, and as you're talking, turn it over to you next. May be able to get to that as we go through it.
Okay. The company goes first in an informal, so whoever wants to take it away.
Well, good morning, Commissioners. I will just get us started as a quick review of the kind of the procedural history. So you obviously issued an order back in January asking all regulated energy providers to come forward and address the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. We filed comments to that on February 15th and then filed an application on March 9th to decrease rates in accordance with that investigation. We've since entered into a settlement agreement with advisory staff, and I'll let Tammy cover it in more detail, but we're simply just here to seek approval of that settlement agreement and as well as the refund plan. I think we've got a fair amount of detail that we'll get into on that and hope to expedite approval of that refund plan if we can today as well. So with that, I'll just pass it off to Tammy.
All right. And
you really get into the weeds.
Well, I'm going to be even probably worse. So, but anyway, we decided we're going to move it around the room today. So, as Carl mentioned, yes, we are requesting approval of the settlement agreement.
The water is out in the hallway.
that we submitted with advocacy staff to you on August 9th, and we believe this is a fair and equitable representation of the impact of the TCJA. You'll see with further discussion, this is not an easy task. It's not a simple line item in our that we can change, and like a sales tax, it's much different than that. Had it been sales tax, something we were collecting at 35 and now needed to only collect at 21, I think it would have been a much easier process to go through. So I'll just say, I mean, we've been working with this in all of our jurisdictions. It is, and there's not one of them that's exactly the same. So it is very complicated, and appreciate all the time spent with staff and working through it. As Carl also mentioned, we are requesting approval of a refund plan, and while the details weren't set out in the settlement, we did not come to specific agreement with staff on how that refund plan should be effectuated. We're going to talk through what we believe is the most efficient and expeditious way to get money back to customers. So we'll walk through that with you today. Again, it wasn't laid out in detail in the settlement agreement, but we will walk through that and be ready for questions. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Travis Jacobson, and he can walk through the basis of our calculations.
Okay, thanks, Tammy. As Tammy mentioned, if the tax is really an iterative calculation on earnings in the current period, in this particular case, we implemented our most recent rates in August of last year. And that was a 2017 projected case period. So with that in mind, and again, we've got 10 different jurisdictions and we're handling just about every one of them differently. With that in mind, what we did is we went back to our most recent case and we determined the impact if in that case we had used 21% rather than 35% tax. So really, there are several impacts to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but the one with the most pervasive impact is really the tax rate at 21%.
So Travis, just to make sure I'm following you correctly. So basically, you went to the 2017 test year and used a 21% tax instead of 35 and calculated what that would have meant in terms of a revenue requirement?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. So the other case, again, was a projected 2017. assuming a 35% rate.
Yep.
So we just went back to that, all same facts, all the same assumptions, and said, I'm going to just change my tax rate.
Okay.
What did that do? You know, from a regulatory model, you have rate base, you earn a return on it, that's really your earnings. All of the other pieces can change, but your earnings stay the same. So we lower the tax. By doing that, you can lower your revenue by the same amount. And in our settlement agreement, we had a schedule showing that. We lowered the revenue, lowered the tax, earnings stayed the same. So that was the first piece of that we went through and analyzed. The second piece, upon enactment of the TCGA, you're required to remeasure the deferred taxes that you had on your books, whether they're a deferred tax asset or a liability. And so in each particular M item, if you will, we looked at them individually and what would have the tax been at the end of 17, assuming a 21% tax rate. So all of those taxes were remeasured at the end of 2017, and we recorded the balances as of that date. That is the piece that is to flow back to customers over a period of time.
Can you say that piece one more time, the second one? Like you said, the first one, I got that. The second piece, just start over on that.
Okay. So at the end of 2017, we had deferred income taxes that were the customer was charged a statutory rate during the past several decades. Mm-hmm. And so what that did, we were able to deduct things for tax that we weren't for books, so you end up with this deferred tax. The customer paid that tax in anything that's in rate base. They paid that tax at 35%, assuming the company then, when that turns around, is going to pay that tax at 35%. When we actually have to pay tax on that, it's going to be at 21%.
Yep.
So there is this balance, if you will, that is sitting in our rate base that will not be paid to the government, so that should be refunded to the customer. So within that realm, again, I mentioned there's deferred tax assets and deferred tax liabilities. On a deferred tax asset, we've actually paid the tax, and then we're going to get a deduction in the future. And a liability where the customer has paid for the tax and the company hasn't paid it yet. So within that, there's really two buckets, if you will. As we have described them, there's plant-related. Generally, those are what's on your rate base. So within that, tax depreciation, we're allowed to accelerate our tax depreciation relative to our book depreciation. It sets it up. If you look at the slide, we have about $61.5 million that is sitting in our rate base that is the difference between 21% and 35%. Our proposal is to treat all plant-related deferred income taxes the same. We do know there are protected and non-protected, but they're all plant-related. They're all in the rate base statement, and we're proposing to treat those all the same. And we're required to return those as a particular rule in the Tax Act on the average rate assumption method, or ARAM. And so out of that $61 million, some of those are very, very long term. We have a lot of 40-year assets on our books. So they'll turn around over time. And just as a point of reference, the 1986 tax law established the same type of an agreement. We turn those around on a different method, but we still have those on our books, and we're still turning those around from 1986. So again, this, it's $61 million. The amount for 2018 is about $1.2 million. That's going to
tell me what the $61.5 million is again.
So on our books, we have, and I don't have the number right on the top of my head, but we have deferred income taxes on our books. Because the tax now has reduced, that amount is higher than it needs to be.
Yep.
It's higher than the amount we're going to pay. So that's the amount that the customer has paid that will be flowed back through rates over time.
Can you give me an example using one of your facilities? Like
so,
the new Tesoro gas plant or one of the wind farms?
So the wind farm, and that actually flows back through the tracker, so it's actually a pretty easy example. That facility has a book life of 25 years. So we take the balance, it was roughly $200 million, we divide that by 25, and that's our depreciation that shows up in our income statement. For tax, it has a five-year life. So when I pay my income taxes for Montana, Dakota, we will get a deduction over 5 years. That plant will have a zero tax balance at the end of 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I've got an asset, I've got accumulated reserve, and then I got book depreciation and tax depreciation. I take the difference of those two, and then I take that times the tax rate. So in 2017 and prior, I was booking those deferred taxes at 35%. Mm-hmm. So over 25 years, my book and tax are going to be the same, but I build up my deferred tax, and then I bring it back down over the remaining life. So whatever we had been able to deduct, we actually did get a 35% reduction in our, or we were able to deduct taxes at 35%. But our income statement only showed that we were using the book depreciation. So it's their timing differences is what they are.
Right.
And if the tax rate is the same over that entire time, it doesn't matter.
So Travis, really essentially it's the timing of the cash benefit.
Yes.
As a result of taxes.
Better say that again into the...
It's the timing of your cash benefit. You receive the cash up front, and so the customers contributed that, mm-hmm. and then you get the benefit right away, and then you amortize it later.
And so now, with this, you're proposing to do what?
Lower the amount of the benefit from 35 to 21. So that means the customer is overpaid that initial amount.
I'm doing this as a... If you have a 61.5, my name is Patrick Fawn, yeah, with the Public Service Commission advisory staff. If you have a 61.5 million balance and your like 2018 amortization is 1 million, 1.2 million, can I divide 61.5 million by 1.2 million and that will be the number of years that you'll be amortizing it?
No.
Okay. How many years will you be amortizing the 61.5 million?
It will depend on how the deferred tax was established. So for the wind farms.
For each project.
For each project. Or each.
Facility or asset.
Yep, each tax group. Yep. So wind farm should be no more than from 2015 plus 25 years. So 2040, that should be gone. If there was a power line, poles, whatever put in 2017, it could be 45 years. So it's over the life of each individual asset that established the deferred tax.
The amortization scale, that's a gradual scale, correct?
Not sure what you mean by that.
It's not a constant. It's not 1.213 every single year.
It will vary.
Right.
So it may be higher some years and lower some years.
Okay. So a better word to be adjustable.
Yep.
To some extent. Okay.
Right.
That was one of the data requests we had requested, and I think by 2021 that number grows to just shy of 2 million.
Yeah, so it does.
So yeah, it's going to vary.
To me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, after this explanation, it sounds so simple.
Wow, that was we're done then.
Very complicated.
So okay, and I hate to belabor this, but it is kind of important for us to understand this piece of it and the deferred, the accelerated depreciation really gets it even more complicated. But give me an example of why it goes up. What's coming in and what's going out that it would increase to 2 million by 2020 or et cetera?
Again,
what projects are adding, and I mean that's what it has to be, right? There's things that are
the 61 million added. Will never be bigger,
right?
That was established. So why is more? Why would the amortization change?
Right.
A perfect example is the wind.
Okay.
So in our Thunder Spirit tracker filing in 2018, there is zero amortization of the plant deferreds. And the reason is our tax expense still exceeds book.
Okay.
So we're able to deduct more on a tax side than we are on a book basis. So we put that in 15. So in about 2021 or 2022, we will see in our rider, and the Thunder Spirit is probably an easy example because it's all contained in that rider, we will start to see significant amount of amortization turning around.
Okay.
So that's a kind of an easy example to see.
And to Travis. Be clear on this whole deferred income taxes, this is just income taxes, like we think of you buy or build something and you have that cost, you spread it out over its life. Production tax credits are completely separate from this, correct?
Correct, and there was no change in that in this act.
And this is Tammy. I just wanted Travis to reiterate that measurement by asset is when it turns around.
Yes.
I mean, that is what was done through our tax software, is looked at every asset, and when that turns around, when that book and tax difference, that's what creates that balance. So it literally was asset by asset, and that ARAM is, that methodology is required by IRS. Otherwise, it's deemed a normalization violation, and then you could no longer use those methods to benefit customers. So this methodology is set by the IRS.
It's an extremely complicated methodology. I found a pretty nice explanation of it, as simplified as it can get from KPMG, but it is still very messy. One thing that kind of helped me to understand why this balance changes is not every asset is going to start to be turned around in 2018. This turnaround that Tammy's talking about is when what they're expensing on their tax books is more than what we're expensing on the regulated books. So that could happen 2018, 2020, 2030 even potentially. It's at some point in the future it could happen, not necessarily in 2018.
And what determines what they're expensing on their tax books versus their regulatory books? The regulatory balance is set, and then the tax fluctuates based on how much revenue you guys have, income and stuff.
Yeah, tax.
We use straight line depreciation for book purposes.
Yep.
Again, for Thunder Spirit, 25 years and 4% a year. Mm-hmm. For tax, we use makers tables, which is modified, accelerated cost recovery. So, for instance, the first year of a five-year maker schedule is 20%. So I'm able to deduct 20% of my asset balance in year one. Mm-hmm. In year two, I think it's 32%, and then it drops off. And within 6 years, I've fully depreciated it. So, but when on our regulated books, it's
25 years of straight, flat depreciation.
And the rates are collecting based on the 25 years?
Yes.
So tell me what the turnaround again is, when what you're collecting or what you're got on the rate base is higher than what you're paying in the taxes, or is it the opposite?
Not on rate base. So
I mean,
so on my income. So if my tax books, if I have a bigger deduction for tax than I do for book, I'm still building my deferreds.
Mm-hmm.
At the point when it turns around is when I establish a balance, and now my book is less than my tax depreciation. Then I start to, I'm having to pay that tax that I collected earlier. So I'm turning it around, if you will.
Okay.
So one more attempt for me on this one. So if you want to try to look at the simplest thing you can. So $100 million asset amortized over 10 years on the regulated books. So $10 million per year is what we would amortize. On the tax books, if we do the makers like Travis was talking about, in years 1 through 5, you're going to be expensing on your tax books more than $10 million. In year 6, it turns around and it's less than that because you don't have $10 million left to amortize on the tax books. So in that year is when that it would make that flip and they would start giving that back.
Mm-hmm. The part that confuses me is like, so if you're collectively, so on that example, you've got $10 million a year on the books, and say you do $30 million and $30 million on the tax side of things. So that's $60 million. That's like, at some point, it's on an annual basis. It's not collectively what you've collected over that time period.
No, it's an annual basis.
All right.
There is a tracking of the cumulative is for what determines when they start giving it back, when they have to start giving it back, is the expense in that year, not the cumulative.
Okay.
So do you have a schedule showing what the amortization will be in future years?
It was in our data requests we had out through 2021. I don't know if the company would have a problem with including that.
No.
I think that would be
somewhere in my file. Here.
Of interest.
Pat, you want to just sit up?
Sure, I can.
I don't know, I didn't bring them. I can certainly. It's actually an exhibit.
Exhibit 2.
Do we have
it? Yeah, it's in an exhibit. Yeah. Yep, it's an exhibit as well.
Yeah, so,
exhibit 2.
The original?
In the March.
March filing?
I believe in the March 9. Which. It's page 4 of 6, exhibit 2, page 4, in the March 9 filing.
Oh.
I didn't include it in the presentation.
ERAM reversal?
Yes. Is someone going to walk through this?
Well, this would this is a representation of that remeasurement each year.
Okay.
So this would be the amortization that would occur each year.
But I don't see the two lines. I don't see the regulated books and the tax books.
Well, that would be by asset, so that would be
okay. So can somebody
this is just
just
a
walk through what this so that just walk through even in 1 year what the numbers are, just to describe them. You have to remember, we are not accountants. We don't deal with this ever, except for now. So you got to.
Actually, it reminds me of my previous life prior to coming to the commission.
So we'll just start in 2018. Mm-hmm. There are different tax classes, if you will, and the company accounts for the tax classes. I mean, we treat them all the same, but they have different characteristics.
Sure.
So within the common, obviously those are our common assets. For instance, our customer care and billing system. So really, it's during 2018, that $233,000, we will pay $233,459 less in federal tax than what would have been paid had the tax rate not changed. The way we do our deferreds, we compute our state net of federal, but it's actually paid federal net of state. So there is an impact to the state tax just in the calculation of our deferred balance. So we will end up paying $8,000 more in state tax than what was in our calculation. And electric plant, same thing. That'd be essentially lines, meters, poles. And then power production, obviously, is our power plants. And again, they're all treated through a maker's schedules and straight line depreciation. It's just that they're classified in their major groups. It's the same concept, it's just a different year. So in 2019, had the tax rate not changed, we would have paid $1,469,000 additional federal tax. And we had collected that federal tax from customers at some prior year. It could have been last year. It could have been 9 years ago.
Because of
the timing. We were able to deduct it before and pay it now. And, you know, one of the Victor had mentioned there's, you know, kind of a tracking of this. It all of these amounts that were paid by customers prior to the company paying those, and again, Garrett mentioned timing of cash, those all sit on the rate base statement. So the customer pays it, they get the benefit of it through a lower rate base, which they pay the return on. So it's not as though the customer doesn't get a benefit of it, but they have paid this, the company will not have to pay it, so therefore it's refunded to the customer in the form of lower rates.
And you had to figure this out for every asset for as long as the depreciation schedule lasted.
That's correct.
And so 2022 isn't the last one.
Nope.
Goes all the way down to.
Yeah.
Like you are for 1986 for the previous tax cuts.
That's right.
There's some that extended way out to now.
Yep.
Our Thunder Spirit would go to 2040.
Yeah. Unless we add something new, but.
And when are these refunded then? Are they refunded gradually, or do you have to do that?
So what our proposal is that what we would do is we would reduce rates to reflect 75% of that amount.
Okay. And we
so
can get into that.
The customers will get the benefit of that every year through lower rates.
And slowly build down the balance of this overcollection.
That's right.
And how long does it take to reduce that to zero?
The balance?
Yeah.
40 years, I suppose.
As long as they're...
As long as...
The longest one.
Yep.
Appreciation.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. And so the only comment I'll make about in 1986, the company didn't have sufficient plant records, so there was an alternative method. South Georgia is what we label it as. There you could do a straight line amortization. We have sufficient records, therefore we're required to use that ARAM method.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had perfect rate making, real time rate making, you would reduce rates again in 2019 by a couple hundred thousand dollars. And on, you know, you'd follow the level of amortization if you had perfect rate making.
If you had perfect rate making and no other assumption changed. Perfect rate making would also say I added an asset and I get a return on that.
Right.
I have an increase in O&M. Okay. I would match all of those. So assuming no other variable changed, I would agree with you.
I should have just stuck with the word real time.
You should have, yeah. Perfect. Not perfect. They're entirely different.
We do perfect rate making.
Not real time. It's just right.
Rewind a minute, Pat.
Okay.
Should I move on to the second bullet?
if you dare.
So non-plant related, another term is non-protected. So if it is not subject to the average rate assumption method or ARAM, there is discretion in how that is treated. The discretion goes all the way back to at December of 2017 when you remeasured, all of those could have just been taken to the bottom line by the company. Or it can be an amortization period that has been established through a rate-making process. In this particular case, our calculation for all non-plant-related deferreds was just about $1.8 million. So this could be items such as PGA, where the customer has paid or the company has paid, and there's a deferred tax associated with it.
PGA.
Purchase gas adjustment.
Okay, PGA.
Customer advances, where the customer has paid in advance and we have a deferred tax asset on the books. Those are the type of things. They're not plant related. They're not poles and wires. It's other types of deductions that the company is able to take.
I understand there's a list of the non-plant related things that you... Is that on this filing? Okay, thanks.
Yep. So the schedule that I just went over with the 5 years, the following page is a list of... And so what the list was put together for was... just to see what an average turnaround time is on those. You'll see some of them are 1 year, and others, such as pension, are kind of like plant. It takes that last person in pension to no longer participate, and at that point, the deferred tax has been extinguished.
I suppose this will be obvious when you answer, but what are the customer advances?
So if we extend to a new subdivision and the cost of that is greater than the revenue requirement that it would produce, they have to pay a down payment to get the line there. If it's refundable to the customer, so if they're hoping to hook up 20 homes, and for every home they get $100 back, then it sits on the books as a customer advance. And then
that's a huge part of this sheet. Is this point in time kind of an anomaly because we had the big surge in growth in some of your communities like Minot and Williston and Dickinson, so there were new subdivisions, and so would in previous years would that have been probably a smaller percentage?
Just so we're clear, that this is total company, so it's all 10 jurisdictions. But I would say a majority of this is probably in gas, and a lot of it's in North Dakota gas, and a lot of it is because of recent activity.
So this being 18% of that, the customer advances is probably higher at this point than in most points over the years.
I think I would agree with that, yeah.
Okay. I think it's interesting, on a side note for people listening in, that probably not in the thousands, but there are always a few people that listen in, and they can't see what we're talking about right now. There are about 50 items just on the non-plant deferred income tax list alone, you know, ballparking 45 to 50 items. And when you think about having to go through all of those, it's a very time-consuming task, which is why we're fortunate to have good advocacy and advisory staff on hand to help grind through these numbers.
So if everybody's okay with that schedule, I'll move on to the next slide, which is really, I think, just laying out the settlement. So in terms of the settlement, what we've been talking about so far is there's really two things that are driving it. The first is the reduction of the tax rate from 35% to 21%. So in our last filing in PU 16666, in order to achieve the same level of earnings, assuming a different tax rate, we will collect $7.2 million less from the customer. Because we don't need to collect the revenue to pay the tax. The second item that the settlement lays out, we're going to amortize a set amount of excess deferreds each year. And the settlement agreement states that we would select 75% of that and use that as a reduction in rates as well. So the total rate reduction is just over $8.4 million.
Well, sooner, I had mentioned at the beginning that one of the big questions I had relates to the 25%. Of the deferred tax that would be applied toward replacing the underground cable. So I'm just going to ask some questions related to that. I did a fast forward through the settlement, and we could talk about it at the end, we could talk about it now, but I think, I don't know that there's one time's better than the other. Was that a manufacturing issue in the 1980? It seems like it's a hard stop at 1983. Is that approximately pre-1983 underground? And is it all? Is it just some of it? Can you give a little background on that? Because I need to know more.
I'm kind of out of my wheelhouse in that. My understanding is that the materials used in the underground cables during that time were subject to failure. There are quite a few outages that relate to those cables in those areas wherever they were at. Once you get past that, the materials have gotten better, and we don't experience failures to the extent we do on the older ones.
Was it material? Was it the copper wire? Was it the sheathing?
The sheathing, I believe.
Sheathing is the problem?
That's my understanding.
Okay. So wasn't it related to, I mean, I assumed it wasn't related to installation, that they're stretching it too much as they're pulling it.
It's more, I think, just an improvement that they've seen since this time frame. And so we probably don't have a significant amount of detail. We're really using these projects as examples. I mean, we can certainly get back to you, but just to back up a bit, you know, we held our case back to projected 17. All of this measurement, this calculation, the tax act didn't occur until 18. So this is a recognition that there's continued investment, continued O&M that's occurred since that rate case, those rates were established. However, since it was so recent, we use that as our method because it doesn't stand at a point in time. You know, we don't just cut it. I mean, in terms of our tax expense for 18, really has nothing to do with 17. But in terms of determining what the amount we should give back to customers, because we recognize if we didn't change our rates, we had obviously over-earned significantly. That's obvious at $7.2 million just for the tax effect.
Sure.
So that, you know, but again, we're using those as examples. Those are, so it's a, as Garrett would better explain than I, it's a cash thing. This amortization would provide funding for projects such as the cable replacement. Those cable replacements are going on today, and we'll continue to do that. We're giving those as examples of distribution investments that would be funded then by these.
But this would accelerate that replacement schedule? I'm assuming because if the money is already parked from, say, the last rate case
whatever
and repairs and maintenance,
replacement, this would be above and beyond.
So it would accelerate the replacement schedule.
It would. But it's not, I just don't want to liken it so much to what we've been talking about in another case.
Right.
This is in more general terms.
And in fairness, I know I said, I think it was when we first issued the requested the TCJA information. I think I mentioned something to the effect of, I'm not opposed, you know, I was perhaps asked the question, does it all go back to the consumer? And I think I said at the time, I don't know for sure. Maybe there's a significant need that can partially be or addressed with a partial amount. So, you know, that's fair for me to mention that again. But I would like to have just a little better handle on, you know, a couple of thoughts I had. Was this in the last rate case, 16666, and I didn't find anything. So now it's showing up, and I don't have a lot to base it on other than I'm all for reliability. That's incredibly important. And we don't want these things to snowball, at least, you know, personally I don't want to see it snowball, and all of a sudden there's a significant impact to a class of ratepayer in a very short period of time. That's not a healthy situation. But anecdotally, do you know that the failure rate is twice as high on the pre-1983 cable, or is it 50% higher? Or
and I don't know that any one of us have that specific number with us today, Commissioner. There are specific, they have these identified, and there is a it is a higher outage rate with underground cabling, which it's wonderful. You don't see the lines. It's miserable to find the fault and to get it replaced. So it's not only it's the time of the outage, in addition to the outage, but that cause when a cable underground cable fails. So it's the time it takes to identify it, find it, replace it, get service restored. But I don't have specifics with me today.
Okay.
I don't think any of us do. On they have these identified. They know where they're at, and they look at as they're failing, and they'll fix it a number of times, and then it goes into a replacement. So there would have been in just general replacement dollars in distribution investment in the last case, but this would be to go out there and get a few more of those completed.
Okay. I mean, I could continue. I've got a couple slightly different questions related to this, and I could keep on the same line in terms of, are these scattered around? Are these? I'll be done in just a couple more questions.
My understanding, they are. When our distribution manager reached out to each one of our regions, so we do see them throughout our system.
Okay. So what I'm really looking for is similar to another example of replacement projects, just some more data. And the other part is, so this 25%. It's indefinite. If the tax code doesn't change for 20 years, this 25% annually that's going into this replacement project initiative, it goes on indefinitely, correct?
Well, each time we file a rate case, we'll reestablish. I mean, as Travis mentioned, we still have the South Georgia amortization. If you looked into our income statement, in the last rate case, you'll see this South Georgia amortization. So each time we file, there's really a revisit of what that. Again, we're looking at a representative number to set rates. And we know the day we walk out of here, all of those numbers change.
Okay.
That's reality, because we don't have real-time rate making, as Pat referenced. But we'll relook at that. In the, you know, it's not that forever it's going to be. I don't think we'll be out for 20 years.
Okay. And I said I just had a couple more, and those are my couple more. So,
And just one clarification on that. Sorry. You know, she said South Georgia. That drops off in a couple years. And ironically, it's about $250,000, which is about the difference in the 25%. So in a couple of years, that goes away. We're not going to get a change in rates because that went away either. Like Tammy said, that would be addressed in the next case along with every other issue.
What I think I heard you just say a few questions back is that the underground cable systems and the LED lighting systems, et cetera, are examples. But this money is not, you're not asking for this money just to target those things. It's just increased revenue, right? I mean, it's more revenue that you're going to be getting or keeping versus.
It'll offset distribution investment. It'll offset O&M increases. It'll, everything that changes from, has changed since we established rates in 17.
Right. It's not going to be parked over here for these two projects. This is increased revenue for you guys.
These are examples of additional spending we know we have facing us as examples.
And so why should we be doing that so soon after the last rate case? Basically readjusting your revenues.
It's a year. We put rates in August of 17. We filed that rate case in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
We report earnings each year to the commission. I mean, I think there's ample opportunity. It's not a windfall of money that it will go to support investments and expenses that we have seen and will continue to see since those rates were established.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the LED lighting is probably a good example of that, in that that was
grab a mic there.
Oops, sorry. The LED street light replacement program wasn't part of the last case, right? So this is a new project that the company, all the company-owned street lamps are being replaced in the communities throughout North Dakota. As a result of that, the usage volumes will be reduced, right? So we know because of that project, you know, we're spending those dollars to replace, you know, those lights. In addition to that, then the volumes will be reduced in each of the communities, the need to light the town. So these are new things that are occurring that we're implementing that were outside then of the last rate case.
Since you broached LED lighting, the municipal lighting,
correct.
Are they getting the best of both worlds when you look at the fact that they're getting the 4.5% benefit from the TCJA change, and then at the same time, all customer classes, that 25% comes from everyone.
Correct.
So they're paying for the replacement, and they're also getting the 4.5% revenue change. Or not revenue, tax benefit.
I guess the benefits then to the communities would be that the city budgets would require less payments to MDU because the electric bills would be lower.
How come that wasn't part of the last rate case, the LED change out?
I think technology probably has changed and improved since we put that case together.
Okay.
The cost of the LEDs have dramatically decreased since the last analysis was done.
Okay. So it seemed more optimal now to tackle that.
I don't think it was feasible before.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
If you don't get this additional revenue, are you going to wait? Or would you incorporate that anyway, just because it's a good time?
We are kicking off the LED replacement program. Mm-hmm. That is going to happen. It's I think, in regard to LED replacement, it's not so much the investment as it is the loss margin. So there is an immediate reduction in what we'll sell.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be using less lights. So that will affect our margin.
Doesn't LED lighting pay for itself, though, in terms of, say, a municipality had to pay for the upgrade? They were responsible for it. Just hypothetically, it would pay for itself.
The municipal will pay a charge for that, for the light, but we will collect that much less. And without resetting rates, if we set out to collect $8 million and we're selling that much less, we won't collect those dollars. So it's not so, it's the investment.
And
allowing the customer to reduce their bill, but that reduction in that bill is a hit to us until we reset rates.
And I realize there's give and take, that the municipality, a project that's not directly related to them, for example, and there's a cost associated with that project, of course, that they are, in fact, picking up a part of that through the rate making process or rate design as well. So I understand that. So I'm not just picking on them on one isolated instance, because there isn't one isolated instance in all of this.
We have about 100 communities where this will be.
Since we're, I'm referring back to Exhibit 2, page 1 of 1 on the August 9th settlement. On that, you're listing just over 100,000 customers. On the previous rate case, I think the number is 92,800. And I actually think it's, I have it somewhere.
I don't have that with me. Probably right.
One residential and one total company or total cost of goods.
That is from the last case.
Yeah, this is the last case. So I think actually lighting is probably one where, if we've counted, this is the last rate case.
This.
These are billing units out of a rate design schedule.
Yeah, these were estimated from the last rate case for the test year. The 92,000 that you are referencing, I believe that was actual customer counts in that year. Versus this, like Tammy was saying, this is billing units, and this is estimate from that case. Even today, if you look at these numbers relative to actual customer counts, it's lower.
It's lower, yeah. We over-projected.
What number was used in terms of calculating customer residential, for example, customer benefit from the TCJA?
Well, these are the numbers used to calculate the rates in the last case, and so we typically say 980. I don't know that that's changed. You know, a 980 kilowatt hour. It's just we over projected in the last rate case what we expected to sell in 2017.
And I think one thing that's important, and Tammy mentioned it earlier, rate making in our last case, it was based on projections. the revenue requirement. The reason that we tended to go this route, it was fairly recent, and all of the assumptions had been vetted by multiple parties. And it's a representation of what the rates would have been had this been in effect. Customer counts are different. Volumes are different. So, again, it's a representation of what the rates would have been had we settled in knowing that the rate was going to change.
Okay.
On this particular slide, the $7.2 million, is that the $7,232,919, that number that was in the settlement? Okay. And then the 75% of the plant-related amortization, is that number supposed to be $1,203,087? And that is 75% of the number on the slide before, 1,213,000.
It's 75% grossed up for tax.
Grossed up for tax, okay.
Pat, I'm sorry, I was looking up a number here. Different than what you were talking about. I think you were clarifying questions that I had for you in advance of this.
Okay.
Or that maybe others had too. So can...
What I was just asking.
Were you referencing why...
I'm trying to...
I had that the $1,203,000 was 75%, and so I'm assuming that's of a little over $1.6 million, and so the additional company revenue would be a little over $400,000.
Wrong numbers.
But somewhere I thought it said $300,000.
300%. Or 300,000 of the 1.2 million. So 25% of 1,213,000.
The difference is due to...
Need to post up for taxes. I mean, that's the difference.
Yeah.
So if I this ARAM and the non-plant, when I put that in, it's just a straight reduction of regulated income tax expense. So if I reduce my tax expense with no other adjustments, the revenue impact is actually more than that. So you have to gross it up for tax, which is entirely not intuitive.
So if
I read that, and I was
if I may, if you look at the ARAM schedule for 2018,
it's perfect, but it's not intuitive.
It's not.
So 1,212,633 is the ARAM reversal for 2018. If you take 75% of that, that is about 900,000 roughly, and 300,000 would be what the company's retaining. If you tax effect that 300,000, it is just shy of 400,000. I think that's the difference you're seeing.
What kind of tax effect does it have? I just have to ask.
It's the actual tax rate, so 21% federal.
So that's their income. They're taxed on it, the 300,000. It's revenue to them.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a reduction of tax expense.
Yeah, it's a reduction of tax expense. And that's taxed?
Yes.
It's not taxed, but in order, earlier I mentioned the regulatory model is I have rate base and I get to earn a return on it.
Yep.
So if I go through and I do all my calculations, in our case, we had about $37 million is what we needed to earn.
Mm-hmm.
So now I add in one piece that says I need to reduce my tax expense. My earnings go up, right? So what do I do then? Then I reduce my revenue. If I reduce my revenue, I pay less tax. So it's this iterative calculation.
Yep. Okay, got it.
And to be represented, it needs to be presented on a pre-tax basis.
So it allows you to charge less and earn the same amount.
Yeah. Got it. So what was that amount again? 400-ish?
Yes, if you would do the same tax affecting to the $300,000 that the company is retaining, it would be it's just shy of $400,000 using that same percentage.
Okay. Continuing on the non-plant excess deferreds. The settlement calls out that the entire non-plant balance, again, just short of $1.8 million, would serve to reduce the revenue necessary to collect under the deferred balances of our trackers. And if you remember, at the settlement and ultimate approval of rates in the last case, we had balances that we were needing to recover from the customers. In each of the environmental, generation, and transmission, we chose to spread that impact to the customer out over 24 months. So we were going to collect through rates a per unit for each KWH or however it's billed to recover those balances over a period of time. At the end of July, you'll see that we have balances in the environmental, 1.6 million, the generation, just under 800,000, and then in transmission, just over 2 million. So our settlement calls out that we would reduce those balances to zero in as many riders as we can with the balance going into transmission, if we can get that far, and we should be able to.
You think you would get into transmission, so environmental would go to zero, generation, you think would go to zero?
Generation.
Because I thought there would still be a balance on the generation side, and it wasn't likely to get into transmission.
And so another month has gone by.
Yeah.
And we're collecting under those three riders. Again, we had asked for it over 24 months. So every month, we had, right off the top of my head, I don't remember the numbers, but we're bringing those balances down in the neighborhood of $300,000 a month.
Okay.
So as of July, we could get rid of environmental, generation, and transmission. If we go to one more month, we'll be able to get in deeper into transmission and reduce those.
Now, you said get rid of, didn't you say you had it spread out over 24 months? So this would only be 12 months. So they're going to continue to collect for 12 more months?
Nope. We would. So what our initial request was, we would put in a per unit and then charge that per unit for up to 24 months until the balance was collected.
Okay.
So in the probably the one that what we would do, so for environmental, and Tammy can probably, or Steph is going to talk about it later, we would collect that entire balance, 1.5 million, and then that rate could be reduced to zero.
You would offset that balance with this amount and then reset the rate to zero.
Right.
Because currently the only thing being collected through the environmental is the deferred balance. So we could then zero that rate out.
And generation and transmission are a little bit different because there are assets in there and they're ongoing riders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So just to address Commissioner Crouch's your question up front, that is some of the difference in what we've noted here as the net change to a customer bill. So in the settlement agreement, the amount that we calculated, as I calculated, we calculated as a group, we looked at what that change in the rider amount would be as an example. Because, again, these amounts will change, so we won't really know the full effect until we get to where we cut this off, because we're going to continue amortizing this. But in the settlement, I took the change in each of the rider amounts, you know, what that incremental decrease would be. In looking at it today, it may make sense to just take the environmental to zero, because those other riders are going to continue on. Customer will get the benefit. It's just, is it worth changing the rate by thousandths of a penny today? Or just because we'll be refiling each of those riders in the fall, this fall, coming fall, which I guess we're in fall now. Seemed like a long ways away. We'll be filing those, and you'll see those credit coming through that tracker. But again, the environmental is different because it's we at this point don't have anything incremental investment we're putting in that at this point in time. And so we would just churn it to zero.
So the 549 wasn't just calculated on the environmental rider going away. It was part of the generation rider going away at the time, which has now, it will go completely away because of
this deferred balance.
Time has
will
moved.
Go away. We'll still have a charge on the generation rider, but the deferred piece of it would go to zero.
So if that's
but again,
the case,
these numbers will change yet one more time.
If that's the case, then the 549 with part of the generation going away, now it's 508, but that actually just takes into account the environmental rider going to zero, the way it's worded on the slide.
Yeah, that's correct. The assumption here is we would change our base retail rates and we would take environmental. The per unit charge is actually, for a residential example, is 0.084 cents. And we would take that to zero. So the line item on the bill would go to zero.
Okay.
And we would reduce the rates. And if that happened, the impact for that would be $5.08. On average, if you use 980 kilowatt hours, and that's go forward. I mean, that's a rate change. So it's that go forward until we change rates again.
So do you have a breakdown of whether it's the 508 or the 549, and I'm trying to remember off the top, I'd have to dig through it, but I think 365 was related to the tax rate itself dropping from 35 to 21%. I think that was 365 or something, and then you start adding in the benefit of riders going away, et cetera, and it moved up. Do you have a breakdown?
I do, and so, I mean, we can, I guess, when we get to when we know that change will be, we could give you exactly what that amount would be. I mean, I can give you what we have today.
Yeah. That'd be okay for me, knowing that it can change on the rider front.
Yeah. I have a...
Before we leave the environmental rider real quick and go to that, is that mostly Big Stone that's being collected through the environmental rider?
Environmental was Big Stone and the Lewis and Clark's.
Oh, yeah.
Matt's project. So okay. We put both of those investments in rates now. So this dollar amount is truly just the deferred balance we're trying to collect.
Got it.
So I think just to clarify on this stuff, it gets a little bit messy. So the conclusion of the last rate case, we moved all investments out of that generation rider, the environmental rider. All that remained was the under-collection balance because of the true-up. Okay. The generation and transmission riders have investments in them. The generation has the Lewis and Clark Rice units, so that needs to continue, even though this balance would be reduced to zero. And transmission would continue. It doesn't. I don't believe it has any current investments in it, but it does is a tracker for the MISO and SPP costs. So again, that one would need to continue, regardless of how low this balance gets. So the
environmental would.
The environmental can go away. Zero. Its only function in life is to collect that under collection balance, and then it zeroes out until the next time the company would get an approved investment within it.
Okay.
Okay.
continue.
A whole bunch of numbers. Travis going to walk line by line.
I don't.
He's got an appointment at 10.
How much longer do you think it takes to explain this?
Honestly, what we'd like to do is spend a little time with the refund plan, if we could. There's some numbers here that you just purely reference and showing that calculation, but if we could take a few minutes to walk through that refund plan.
Go ahead.
We'll leave you with these schedules just showing the calculations.
Okay. I'll just quickly walk through this proposed refund plan that Tammy has mentioned. It would be for refunding the 2018 dollars up through the date of implementation of new rates, which we are targeting an October 1 rate change for purposes of this discussion. The refund plan would refund 4.5% of the January through September 2018 revenues, excluding that collected through the trackers. Once we know that number, we can determine the refund per rate class. We are proposing that we refund through a bill credit starting no later than November 1st, 2018. The rate would be applied to customers' bills, customers' actual use in November. We would identify the line separately as the Tax Act refund, and based on current estimates through July, it would be approximately $28 would be refunded in the month of November.
So a one-time refund of the money that was over-collected.
Correct.
And then lower rates moving forward.
Yep.
Have we already lowered the rates? Did we approve a temporary lowering? Or did we do that? No.
We did in the riders.
In the riders,
failed to mention that earlier. So, for example, our renewable rider, we lowered that in April, and our generation rider was also changed in April to reflect the change in the tax rate. So those unit amounts we're charging today are already reflective of the 21% tax rate. Transmission didn't require a change because there's no investment in that, so there was no effect of the Tax Act associated with the transmission rider. But our retail rates have not changed, and so that's what this is addressing. So, again, we're talking representation. Since the rates were not changed, we have to differentiate in order for us to efficiently do this, differentiate this from an interim collection. So you're familiar with when we collect rates on an interim basis, for example, in a rate case, we're collecting those dollars and we're putting them over here. And we know exactly what we collected from every customer under that interim rate, unlike this case here where we do not. We've said now we've come to a determination what rates should have been. We're trying to represent what that revenue amount is that we over-collected. And so that's the reason why it's different than what you would typically see from us on an interim refund.
So if refunds went on November 1st, how many months is that through October? Is it estimated or is it?
We're proposing 1 month. I mean, we could do it over two. So again, we're going to take this lump sum amount of dollars that we would know about mid-October, because we're going to look at what revenues did we collect through September. We're going to reduce those revenues by 4.5% by class and say, okay, we've got this amount of dollar to refund, and we're going to do that in the month of November based on what customers use in November. So if you will come up with a per unit charge and apply that to your use in November, and that's your refund.
And is it estimating the usage for October too?
It'd be just the usage for November would be estimated. So we'll never hit it exact.
Isn't that low?
Through September, you'll know them.
It would be the
4.5% would be applied through
we changed
September's
rates
revenue,
October 1.
And we're changing rates going forward October 1.
Okay. How does November usage, though, compare in the summertime? It's significantly higher than November 1st, correct? The furnace is starting to run a little bit, but it's not running nonstop like it would in January. The air conditioner isn't working overtime like it does in July. That's
yeah, because we're dividing by those November sales. So the per unit would, as Travis said, would be higher.
And where did the 4.5% come out? Where did that number come from?
That's what the $7.2 million, or excuse me, $8,436,000
is 4.5% of
Our what our current retail rates produce.
So I see.
Yeah, it's shown on the exhibit in the settlement.
See. Okay. Thank you.
And so is your assumption that it's going to take us a month to make a decision, and then you need 2 weeks to figure out the numbers, and then so it would start the following, you do the refund the following month? Or
well, to efficiently do this, we really need to change rates on the first of the month, so our assumption is we're not going to get it done September 1. So that leaves us October 1. So we're doing our best, but we don't have a good vetted number of revenues other than month end when we close the books. So that in order to get through September 30 revenues, we would then change rates October 1. So I guess our proposal is not so much trying to make assumptions when you will do something. We're trying to say that this is how we could do it most efficiently.
So you need an end-of-month cutoff, and then you need a couple weeks to figure it out, and then the refunds would go out the following month, is what you're saying.
Thank you, yes.
Okay.
But at the same time, rates will be lower on a go-forward
basis October 1st.
Or the first of whatever month follows when we make a decision.
Right.
Sufficient time to get us into a rate change.
I don't have any other questions on the refund plan, but I do have some other questions, so I don't want to get off track on the refund plan if others have.
Your other questions are for the company or for advocacy?
Mostly for advocacy, but.
Do you have anything else for the company first?
Not that may want to jump in.
Not that they're leaving, but just
well, not that I couldn't circle back. I think I'm pretty good right now. I've got a few for.
Do you want a number representing the per kilowatt refund based on this estimate of $4.8 million?
I think they did that $25, wasn't it? Do you mean a customer number?
Or yeah, right. Do we have that?
Yeah, they provided that.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
$28.
And that's average. An average, 980.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.
Yes.
Some will be higher, some will be lower.
Right.
Okay, let's keep rolling. I know there's some timing constraints here, so.
So we spent a lot of time talking kind of about the mechanics just so we could understand the numbers. But the big question from a policy standpoint is the 25%. So I guess I'd like to hear from you guys why you felt that it was appropriate for the company to keep any of this.
Sure. I think from our perspective, it's a recognition of the couple of things. One, that expenses do increase from year to year. And then kind of looking at what happened with actual rates in the full year 2017. So the rates from the last rate case were set for the year 2017. Part of it was due to weather, but part of it was due to expenses being a little bit different, usage being a little bit different than what was estimated. The company under-earned in 2017 by about $3.5 million.
Is this all reflected in that chart we didn't go through?
I don't think it's in that. I don't think this is in that chart.
Okay.
This is in their annual report filing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of lays out the under-earnings for 2017.
And what was that under-earned amount?
It was approximately $3.5 million.
And you felt that was a result of?
In my opinion, it's due to the weather being not quite as harsh as what the normal would be, and then the customer counts and usages being less than what was estimated for the full year.
Are there customer charges? Have we increased their customer basic service charges?
In the last case, we did, yes.
Significantly? I can't remember.
I don't recall. I don't believe it was significantly. I think AARP actually signed on to that one, so it could not have been very significant.
So
we had been moving in that direction for a couple of rate cases as well, so I don't think it was as dramatic as, say, the last couple of rate cases we've
been. Right.
And isn't that part of the goal of that is to mitigate that what we just talked about, the weather impacts and how those swings affect their
The higher earnings? You raise that basic service charge, the less impact weather would have on the company's bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, you guys, just to put this a little more into perspective, I think from our approach looking at this settlement, this is, in essence, a single-issue rate case, and as much as we try to avoid this, when we made our filing in 17-490 at the end of last year, we recognized that this is going to have a dramatic benefit to ratepayers to have this single-issue rate case, and of course, the commission moved upon that. We did look beyond, I mean, exactly with the Tax Act, as well as cash flow and revenues to some degree, to the extent that we could, considering that this wasn't a full-blown rate case. And so the end result that we were looking to reach is just in reasonable rates. However, we were erring heavily inside to get money back to the ratepayers. And if you see, even with the under-earnings, the vast majority of this will get back to the ratepayers, and it almost nullifies the previous rate case with its results. And so when we really looked at the end result of the settlement, we saw that we felt, as advocacy staff, that it was a just and reasonable rate. It did have substantial benefits to the ratepayers in a reduction of rates, and the amount returned back to them, as well as reduced, it was heavily in favor and erred on the side of actually benefiting the ratepayer as opposed to giving any sort of returns to the company.
So that's an interesting point. You said that it almost nullifies the last rate case. What would this the rates be that were approved in the last rate case and then adjusted with this? What would be the difference there?
I thought it essentially eliminates the increase from the last rate case, 16666.
Yeah, we're within about, what, $50,000?
Right, right. It's extremely close.
So $8.485 million versus $8.436.
Okay, so many, you're saying right there, what page you on there, Travis?
Page 9.
Okay.
So if the last case had considered the facts that we have in the settlement agreement, the rate increase that would have resulted would have been $49,491. If you go up a little bit, the authorized revenue increase that Victor had pointed out was granted was $8,485,497. So, as Victor pointed out, it nearly nullified that, save for $49,000.
So, in effect, there probably would not have been a rate case back in. But nobody knew about the TCJA at the time.
One other kind of point, company just reminded me of this. The under collection balance application of the non-plant items. So if you go back to those earlier slides, let's see, it just kind of helps display it a little bit better. So slide 5. So if you look at that total ARAM balance, $61.5 million, so that is the plant total balance of excess deferred income taxes. If you look at the non-plant, you can relate the $61.5 million to $1.7. So the treatment of that is very different in other states. It's wide-ranging. So in some states, they're actually passing that back in a similar method to ARAM. So we would see that 1.7 million passed out over 30, 40 years in some cases. The company initially proposed 10 years, which we kind of, what our feeling was is that kind of spreads it out so thin that it's almost not a very big customer benefit. This, with this agreement, we're getting the full benefit in the first year of that by applying it to those under-collect imbalances. That was a pretty big incentive for us.
It's fair to say that there's given a little bit of give and take, even though this is, you know, on the surface, you would look at this and think, well, this has to be simple, right? It's just a...
I don't think anyone...
A little bit of a tax change, and I'm being facetious, of course. There's nothing simple about it. But I think for the public, they sometimes wonder, you know, why, and obviously we want to get it right, but I'm also very anxious to see customers experience the relief from the TCJA, and clearly there's a benefit, not just on the utility rate, with utility rates, but there's a benefit across so many different segments that ultimately benefit consumers and businesses, which are also seeing a nice break on their utility rates, which might equate to, and it should equate to, more working capital to hopefully grow. Did you have...
I'm still following up on the amounts that the comparison to the last rate case. So if you're a customer hearing this, that this basically nullifies the last rate case, then the next assumption you kind of make is, so they were just raising rates in order to collect taxes to send to the government. And so that we need to be able to answer. I'm sorry, but that's kind of the way you would logically think it through if you don't understand all this stuff.
Sure.
What do you say?
Sure. I definitely don't think that's the actual case, and I don't think you would think so either. But the last rate case was really due to company investments in numerous items. I mean, environmental, renewable, transmission, distribution assets. That's what the last rate case was really for. This reduction, it's oddly, eerily similar in amount.
In the amount.
You could easily make that assumption, but it's really simply a coincidence. but I can definitely see where someone could make that connection.
Yeah, well, we'll have to be careful how we could talk about it, because that's...
But to rephrase it a different way, the last rate case was about $8.5 million of new investments. This is a case where the TCJA is essentially going to pay that for the customers.
That would be another way to look at it, absolutely.
A more pleasant way.
Much more.
We have a little... somebody needs to take care of something else. Let's take about a five-minute break. I really want to finish this informal. I don't think we're far from done, but let's take a real brief break here. But
I could...
hearing after that very short recess, but before we do, I just want to announce a good friend of mine is in the room, the majority leader of the North Dakota State Senate from District 37 in Dickinson, Senator Rich Wardner, leader of one of my two favorite groups in all of government.
What's your second favorite?
I didn't say first and second. I said one of my two favorites.
What are the two favorites? Here and there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would be a part
just
of...
Just making sure.
I desire to be a part of no other. Okay. I don't... Whoever has a question, I guess. We're just at a nice break point.
I'll throw it out there one more time just because it's the one area that I'm... still questioning, and that is the adjusting the rates relatively soon after the last rate case after 1 year of earnings. You know, I'm just not 100% comfortable with the 25% and allowing the company to keep that. So if there's anything else that y'all want to say in that regard as a justification, I'm all ears.
I think if we go back, you know, again to the non-plant edits, we had in our initial filing said we want to amortize that over 10 years. That is the life of those assets, right? That's the average life. So in what the company then in the settlement agreed to is that we'd take that $1.8 million of cash and give it back right away instead of taking about $170,000 over 10 years. We're saying we'll take that $1.8 million cash, give it back to the customers right away. So that is something that the company gave up in the settlement as well. So as you mentioned before, Commissioner, it was like a give and take through the process. Because originally, again, if you looked at the life of those assets that comprise that balance, it's about 10 years. So if you want to match the life of the asset with that amortization, it should have been 10 years. But the company is willing to give that $1.8 million up and apply that against the trackers.
And on an annual basis, what's that, Garrett? Did you say $170,000?
$170,000, right.
Okay.
Yep.
So a little
And that is net of tax, so you have to gross that up for tax, which would be, what, $250,000 maybe, something like that.
So it's like there's a, because you're not amortizing it over 10 years,
right.
There's a component that the customer doesn't have to pay for the value of the dollars over those 10 years.
They right.
get a return on that or what? Is there any
right,
return?
Correct.
There
yep.
is.
Yep.
So that the customer won't have to pay that going
correct.
Forward.
Yep.
And that amounts to how much?
It would depend upon what was in rate base related to that. So if there were deferred tax assets or deferred tax liabilities in rate base, to the extent they come out of rate base, the customer's not paying a return on that. Right off the top of my head, I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Got some questions for advocacy. And at the beginning, I had mentioned in my opening remarks, also talked a lot about the 25%, asked a lot of questions related to the integrity of the cable, what's triggering that. So it was the pre-1983 install. I don't know if that means pre-1983 cable or if it was cable on hand and you had enough to keep moving forward. But with that said, I don't want to say that I'm uncomfortable with the 25%. I would, as mentioned earlier, would like to see more data and just have some science behind that. But with that being said, it wasn't brought up in the last rate case. It wasn't included as a part of the revenue request. But am I also maybe, do I need to look at this a little differently in that these are just examples, it was ongoing already, and what was your approach when you looked at it? Say, hey, you know what, the LED lighting is taking place already, some of the replacement is taking place, or the LED wasn't taking place?
But that's more of an example than anything. From staff's perspective, all of those projects are going to probably happen anyway. This would, from the company's point of view, kind of help them from a cash basis to help cover those, that cash need between now and the next rate case. But we don't see this as somehow approving those investments. You know, certainly those investments will have to come out of the next rate case for inclusion in base rates, or in rate base, sorry.
If it wasn't looked at in that respect, do you think it's... It would have been more likely that a rate case would have come before the commission sooner versus doing it this way?
I think so, you know, to some degree. I mean, we can never,
right.
from staff's side, predict when a rate case is going to happen, but does this help prolong a rate case? I think it does to some degree.
Okay.
Go ahead. So to an extent, even when we were discussing the settlement in the first place, when that was in there, my initial reaction is why even put in what these are going to, because it really doesn't matter what these are going to. Ultimately, we thought maybe it would be good to have a frame of reference of what that money could be going to, but for all intents and purposes, it could just as well not be in there what they're particularly specifying.
So
But, I mean, I appreciate it having examples, sure. Even though one of them I like better than the other. But with the examples, it suggests to me that the customer benefits because this money is going to be used for investments and potentially puts off the next rate case, which ends up oftentimes leading to a rate increase, and then there's the costs of the rate case. So that seemed like a good thing. But now in discussion this morning and hearing that the company under-earned by $3.5 million, it leaves me wondering, well, is this just additional money that will go back to the investors and that it's not going to be used for investments into the system and do anything to put off a rate case? So quell my fears.
And I'll pass this along to Victor because he knows a little bit more about the earnings and under-earnings as I have looked at his spreadsheet.
That's a good maneuver, Jack.
I would say it does more to put off the next rate case than it does to pay for any particular investments. I mean, the $300,000 relative to the actual cost of the those couple of references, the LED lighting and the cable replacement, I mean, this is, what, less than 2 or 3% of the total cost of those projects. So it's not going to do very much if you looked at it from that perspective. I mean, they're interesting references for, you know, things that the company is spending money on this year. But it's certainly not why we agreed to allow them to keep that 25%.
And is 1 year with kind of an odd weather pattern or extreme weather pattern a good test of whether the rates are right?
I don't think there ever is a perfect year. I've looked at a lot of history since I've been here, and I've never seen a perfect year.
Probably the year you were born, Vic.
Victor, maybe one thing you can explain to the commissioners then is maybe what you would expect for a normal year, because this was, as you said, an abnormal year. What type of earnings you would anticipate? Possibly in 2008. Of course, we're all speculation,
sure.
But we feel staff are exceptions.
Sure. This is just guesses. I mean, you know, it's if it were a normal year, I would still have expected that 2017 would have under-earned if it were a normal usage year. But part of that would have been based on the customer counts being less than anticipated as well. So it's the trouble with rate making. There's a lot of estimates that need to happen even when you're doing a test year that's ongoing at the time you approve rates. But all of the things being considered, I would still expect with this refund, with the rate reduction, my assumption is the company is likely to continue to under-earn in 2018 to a much lesser degree, but my gut is they will likely under-earn.
So even without the retaining of the 25%, you wouldn't be surprised if they came in for a rate case next year?
Not necessarily. I think that's really the company's decision. I mean, sometimes they'll stay out for quite some time with under-earnings.
Okay.
Sometimes they won't. I mean,
but generally speaking, though, on the $3.5 million, the under-earnings, largely due to weather, not due to rate design?
I guess it depends on which part of rate design. You know, if you're talking the basic service charge versus volumetric charge, you know, it's kind of that whole idea that we talked a little bit about where we said the higher you raise that basic service charge, the less weather impacts the company's earnings.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what makes single issue rate making so difficult, and that's why, at least from advocacy staff's standpoint, we try to avoid as much as possible, and you'll see a lot of companies in other states grumbling that the tax reform resulted in single-issue rate making, and they weren't absolutely fond of that. But we did take all those considerations, all those different variables into consideration as much as we could when we were looking at, again,
just and reasonable rates and determining whether we felt that this would fall under that category. The if you look back in 1986, what the commission did and their presidents, they didn't actually look at any of this. They essentially just said, are you excessively over-earning? And if they were, then they'd give some money back. And the vast majority of the companies were not, and so they essentially had nothing to do with regards to refunding money back to the customers. I think we took it a step further when we looked into these. We looked a little deeper into the company, and we also, again, leaned much more heavily into it's not a matter of excessive earnings. We got to make sure that the vast majority of this tax reform is getting back to the ratepayers. And with our discussions with the company, and fortunately, due to the fact that this rate case was so close, we were actually able to have a better representation of the costs and a lot of the mm-hmm. different variables. And ultimately, when we did look at that, taking into that consideration, the year that may be a little bit off, and what we anticipate, of course, is quite a bit of speculation with that, but what we did anticipate for earnings or under earnings going forward, we determined this would still fall very much in favor of the ratepayer and being just and reasonable.
So this might be my last question, but so what's lost by the approach of saying give it all back, and if the rates are wrong, let's have a full-blown rate case and set them in a way that's appropriate?
Commissioner, that's absolutely something the commission could do. Advocacy staff wouldn't be opposed to that, but ultimately when we were going through the negotiations, we did feel this was a just and reasonable settlement and a just and reasonable rate that they were left with. And still, when you said a lot of give and take, I felt the company actually gave up in this case, again, due to the proximity of the rate case, more give than probably take with regards to the rates.
Because of the plant, non-plant, that piece, the non-plant deferred tax component?
Well, not just that, but in the vast majority of the amount is getting back to the ratepayer, aside from that small.
Why wouldn't it, Jack? Sure. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me why that's such a big give. It's a tax that they're collecting to pay the government, and the rates got cut.
Sure.
So I don't think customers look at that as a big give.
Sure. Well, it was the non-plant unit as well as the vast majority of the amount. And you're right, the commission could just as well have just said, hey, just give all of that back. And, of course, there is also the benefit of pushing off down the road another rate case. So we could have just said give it all back, and the vast majority and also discussed how we would like to resolve this case going forward. And that would also push the case down the road, possibly, if there was some sort of it was contested. And with that, of course, then it would also be a longer period of time from when the ratepayers would actually receive the benefits of this. And so there's also the benefit of this rate case, or with a settlement, of making the approval much, much more expeditious. Since it was within the just and reasonable realm that we looked at, and it also allows us to get the rates back to the customers sooner than later, which ultimately benefits the customers who overpaid in the meantime. Because the further down it gets the road, sure, it's hard to match that back to the original ratepayers that were overcharged. There's also a matching benefit for the ratepayers as well.
So the amount, really, when you look at the 25%, and it's not 25% of the entire TCJA. We have to be very clear on that, because at first glance, wow, you know, a quarter is going to be reinvested. That's not the case. It would be very small in terms of customer benefit, in terms of how their bill looks, but they're still receiving a benefit, because this could certainly extend the length of time between the last rate case and the next rate case while addressing some reliability concerns. We can't ignore the fact that they're but again, I had asked for some data on that, just so I have a little better handle on how significant and severe that is.
But they've said multiple times that it's not being targeted towards those specific investments. It's
right, but it's
increased
listed
revenue that is going to be used to address those investments, which would have been made anyways. So I don't think we can.
No, but you know what? In fairness,
squarely say that
they're going to list that as an example in the in the settlement, and it's specifically listed as an example, that gets my attention. I want to know what's the reliability concern that's out there. I didn't broach the subject. The company broached it. So I would like to see more, just a little more on that. It doesn't have to be a thesis to get to the master's degree, but I'd like to see more.
If I could just get that down to a little more definitive, what you're requesting then? How would you probably describe what we would provide to you then?
Frequency of just how it compares to the underground that was installed after 1983. Is the failure rate twice as high? What's the ratio? So frequency and that would probably actually, and then is that frequency, even the higher frequency, is that beyond the normal range of reliability, or if it, does it still fall into the normal range of reliability that customers should be able to expect?
And one additional thing to also address, Commissioner Fedorchak's discussion with, what if instead you guys just didn't want to accept that? That's absolutely fine as well, at least from advocacy staff's perspective. We did feel that this is just and reasonable. We did feel that this was a great benefit to the customers as well as just and reasonable within that range. However, this was a proposal to bring in front of you, and that was our goal, is to really bring something to you. You have the opportunity to look at it, review it, as we're doing today. And if there's something you didn't like or there's something you want to put in a different direction, that certainly is something that we could sit down to discuss and move forward as well. So along with what, if you look in the memorandum that we filed, we hope to have something in front of you for September 30th so that you either say yes or no, we want to move in that direction.
Okay. Sounds good.
And this, I think, is directed toward Victor. My earlier supposition was that doing this would theoretically delay a rate case, but it's a small amount. If it did, it probably wouldn't be by much, and that's all theoretical. But is this a fact? By leaving that small amount with the company for reinvestment, whenever and for whatever amount the next rate case proposal from the company will be, it will be this much smaller because they will be experiencing these revenues.
Yeah, I think you could say that. So when the revenue requirement is calculated on that test year, whenever the next rate case is, it wouldn't exclude that 25% at that time.
It would be this much smaller.
Yep, absolutely.
So this would do something to levelize, or I can't remember the term we use.
Normalize?
When we're switching from one rate class to another, to be more accurate, we don't want the rate shock. This would levelize and lessen rate shock that occurs for all classes whenever the next rate case comes, correct?
Certainly.
I don't have
anything else. Commissioner Crash, just you?
No, just thank you, everyone, for being here today, and I have a much better grasp, level of comfort, to be honest, than I did. And not that I didn't come in, just had some questions, and I thought this was very good. Thank you. And the staff as well. A lot of work goes into this on both ends.
Are there any objections to the evidence that's been presented this morning, both oral and written, being made a part of the record for making a decision?
We have no objections.
Mr. Chairman, there are just a couple of housekeeping things. I think, in essence, the commission requested a couple of late filed exhibits, specifically a breakdown of the riders and the rate base reductions.
Right.
Some information regarding that as a late filed exhibit, as well as the frequency of underground failures for the lines.
What's realistically, I don't want to delay the project or the project, the settlement over just that element. Do you think it's something that, in a very general sense, that can be provided within a short period of time?
Commissioner, I do. Yes, we can provide a little more detail around.
Okay. We can always dive deeper
talking about
in
later that if we regard. Need.
Okay, thank you.
One other. Yes. Two. Go ahead.
And also for the purposes of the exhibits and the record, we would request that the staff's memos that have been filed under case number 17-490 and 18-89 be included in the record as well for commission consideration with regards to tax reform.
That will be the case. And did you have any objection to this morning's testimony being made part of the record?
No objection, Mr. Chairman.
And one other request is, I think you indicated that you had an analysis of the benefit to the customer of not spreading or not amortizing the non-plant deeded over the 10 years. There's a benefit to the customer there. And you had analyzed that, is my impression?
Or you could?
I could. I have not.
Okay. So if you could provide something showing that benefit to the customer.
Okay. There was no objection to the evidence this morning being used as part of the record, so it will become part of the record upon which a decision will be made. Is there anything else that needs to be added in this matter? This informal hearing then is closed. Thank you. Okay.